but I'm just going to start off with a talk about the future of lunar exploration, which is, of course, entirely appropriate, because this is the year that we're celebrating 50 years since humans first walked on the moon. And also, after this long hiatus, it now looks like humanity is ready to return to the moon. In fact, we already are. We're living in the next era of lunar exploration. And indeed, you may have seen various news items that suggest a certain quickening of the pace in terms of some of the initiatives and missions being launched. And it's kind of about time. The original space race was, of course, just between the US and the Soviet Union. And there was this sort of, that kind of, it was the Cold War that accelerated the interest in the moon. And really, as soon as each nation had launch capability, they were firing all kinds of impactors, surveyors, flybys, orbiters to go and look at the moon. Through the mid-1960s up to the early 1970s, there were a total of about 65 artifacts to reach the moon. And 10 things were sent to the moon alone in 1971. Now, we don't see that kind of activity yet, but that's the kind of era we're going to be entering. And of course, within those huge number of missions sent to the moon included the six Apollo landings on the moon. Including, of course, the first one that we are celebrating this year, Apollo 11, which landed in July 69, just here on the edge of the Sea of Tranquility, which is at the head of the rabbit. If you don't know the rabbit, there's the body, there's the tail, head, and the long ears. So it's just part of the rabbit. And the landing place is here. You can see it from a 1967 planning image from one of the American lunar orbiters. And it's a 25 by 25 kilometer region centered around this crater here called West Crater. So that was what they used in the planning. If we zoom in, you can see a much more modern image of the same region where this is West Crater. However, there is also a difference between this image and the one you saw obvious. Now, it's like a spot the difference, except I know what I'm looking for, and it's probably a little bit more difficult for you. But, let's see, do we zoom in, or shall we see? There's a little shadow there, okay? And that shadow, with this useful yellow arrow that they painted on the surface, is the lunar module, the landing module from Apollo 11. And the designated surface landing area was actually close to the West Crater, and they went further across to Little West Crater. Now, this image is taken with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is one of these return missions to the moon that's busy mapping the surface of the moon. But one of the things it's done is also surveyed all the Apollo lunar all the Apollo landing sites. And here's just a little movie that shows you a close-up of some of this area. So as the mission came in, well, actually, let's just go back. As the mission came in, the landing site was planned to be around West Crater. If any of you have seen First Man, the Neil Armstrong, the film about the moon landing, Neil Armstrong, they were supposed to land on the flanks of this crater. When they flew over, they saw it was strewn with boulders and debris. And he took the controls and piloted the module further towards a sort of flat landing area there. So this object here is the lunar module, and you can very clearly see some of the foot pads. And it's dark because wherever the astronauts trod on the regolith, the soil on the surface, they changed its reflection, and so it reflects the light. So it's very dark around the base, lots of treks out to where the TV camera is based. Down here you've got some of the science experiments they put up, including things to detect any sort of moon quakes and to measure the distance of the moon to the Earth, so to reflect lasers. And then there was this last excursion that Neil Armstrong made. And again, if you've seen the film, that's where they poetically sort of suggest he goes and throws his daughter's bracelet into the crater. And sorry, if you haven't seen the film, it's true. So apologies about that. But yeah, all the record of the Apollo landings are on the moon. However, it's now a long time since we've been sent people to the moon. The last lander was in Apollo 17 in December 1972, and after that, all interest in human exploration basically ceased or certainly human exploration of the moon ceased with the conclusion of the Apollo program. And at that point, the Soviet Union turned its attention to building space stations. Here's one of the early versions, Mir. They turned their attention to going to Venus. NASA and the Americans looked at exploring Mars, sending missions to Mars and further out into the solar systems, much more ambitious problems, programs using robotic exploration. And the moon was just ignored, basically, for several decades. So a few facts about the moon, because you can't miss it in the night sky tonight. Its diameter is just short of 3,500 kilometers, so that's about a quarter of the width of the Earth. Its whole area, well, okay, the average distance is about 384,000 kilometers, and that's the same as if you lined 30 Earth diameters on the end. The surface area is only one-tenth of Earth's, and it's equivalent to about a quarter of the Earth's land area, so if you ignored all the sea. So if you combine Canada and US and Russia, that would be about the amount of land area there is in the moon. The volume is only about 2% of the Earth's, and the gravity is about 17% of Earth. So this is why when you see astronauts on the moon, let's see if I can get this to work. Sorry about the noise. They bunny hop, because despite wearing their huge, you know, heavy spacesuits and their air tank in the back, there's little enough gravity pulling them down. And as you can see at this point, what I'm told is as soon as you start to bunny hop down a slope of the moon, you can accelerate, and of course, accidents can happen. But the advantage, of course, of being low gravity is that you just bounce up again. How about that one? This is my favourite. Down, and it goes straight back again. So that's what it means to be in that kind of low gravity. Right. So it's not until 1990 that interest in a return to the moon started to reawaken, and it's been accelerating ever since. This little movie you see is from a Japanese mission called Kaguya, which went orbited around the moon in 2007. And since this date of 1990, there have been 25 missions to the moon, over 25 missions to the moon, and this includes orbiters like this from the Japanese Space Agency, and landers and rovers. Now, this just shows you that it's not just a race between the Americans and the Russians anymore. This, for example, is the Japanese Space Agency orbiter. They plan to put a small lander called SLIM, so artist's impression, they haven't sent it yet, but that stands for Smart Lander for Investigating Moon, and it's going to land and investigate a volcanic hair of the moon, and that's planned in 2020, 2021. And here, it's not so much the science, but you're still working out techniques of landing safely and doing completely remotely. So autonomous robot landers being able to choose their landing site and land it carefully and precisely with sort of great accuracy without input from the ground. So Japan have a space program to go back to the moon. India had sent an orbiter called Chandrayaan-1 10 years ago, which mapped the surface of the moon looking at reflectance of different colours, looking for the ice content, and you know what water and what form of water and where it is on the moon. So here you just have the basic topology, and this gives you an idea of where there might be ice or water embedded in the moon. So there is some water on the moon, but it's still very, very dry. It's about as dry as a desert on Earth. It's important we have water because we can make fuel, we can make air. It's nice to know where it is, and that's an important thing about sending humans perhaps back to the moon. We want to send them back where there may be these reservoirs of water. The Indians are launching Chandrayaan-2 next month, and this is not just going to be an orbiter that looks at reflectance of light to the moon, it's going to be an orbiter and a lander and a rover, and that's going to land somewhere down near the South Pole and do sort of on-site chemical analysis of the soil. So that's being launched, you know, next month. The Chinese have an incredibly ambitious program of going back to the moon. First, they put missions in orbit. So there was Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 2, which were lunar orbiters. And They continue this very careful staging of their aims. Chang'e 3, this is a picture from Chang'e 3, landed on the surface in December 2013. And that was the first spacecraft to soft land, from crash land, on the surface of the moon since 1976 from one of the Soviet landers at the time. And it let out a little rover called U2, and that was the first rover on the moon since 1973. So it's been a huge gap, you know, 40 years between the last missions like that and the current ones now. Now, the Chinese space program's been in the news just this year because Chang'e 4 landed on the moon in the first week of January. And it didn't just land on the near side of the moon, because that's where we send astronauts, that's where we send objects, because we understand the near side of the moon, we can easily communicate with it. This is what the near side of the moon looks like. This is what you'll see tonight when you go outside. The far side of the moon, the bit we never see from Earth, looks very different. It doesn't have so many of these dark seas. We call them maria. They're not really seas, they're volcanic seas. And these are caused when all this cratering, the big cratering, the very early cratering happened on the moon. It punched through the crust of the moon. The inside of the moon was still lava and molten rock, and it welled out and filled the impact basins to create these smooth basaltics or volcanic plains. We don't know why there are so many on the near side of the moon compared to the far side. So there's a big difference between the two. And we reckon most of that cratering happened about 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago. The Chinese are going to land, well, they have landed, sorry, on the far side of the moon, down in this basin. This is a big impact basin. It doesn't show so well here. This is a map of the topology. So red is high, and then you go down to blue is lower. And this is the biggest impact basin on the moon, and actually the biggest one in the solar system, we think. It's 2,500 kilometers across, 13 kilometers deep, and we think it was a massive massive object, maybe 200 kilometers across, that hit the moon early on and didn't just go smacking, but sort of plowed in at an oblique angle and sort of scoured out a trough. So this is very exciting. If you land there, part of the idea of the science is to study perhaps some of the history and geology around that, and that maybe will allow us to date the very early start of all the impacts on the moon much more precisely. And also try to understand the difference between the near side and the far side of the moon, about why one should be covered in the lava seas and one isn't. Of course, the problem about landing on the far side of the moon is that you cannot be in contact with your spacecraft. And the way they do this is they have a sort of satellite here that sits in a halo orbit just beyond the moon, and it can relay messages from Earth to the lander and from the lander back to Earth. But it does mean that when this was landing, there was no immediate contact. You could not land Chang'e 4 on the moon by remote operation, especially during that crucial final descent. So this is a slightly sped up movie from Chang'e 4 as it's landing. And it's having to use high precision lasers and high definition cameras to map, register and avoid hazards. So things like ditches, like the boulders, say that Armstrong had to avoid in Apollo 11, and to choose a nice, relatively flat area for it to land. So this is a really important technique of, again, autonomous landing of missions. And there'll be some thrusters, I think, that kick in a minute. And the thing that lands, of course, this is Chang'e 4. As it lands, it then folds out its solar panels, pops up the antenna so it can talk back to Earth, and then there's a little ramp that folds down and releases U22, another rover. Now, if you look at the view as it comes in, there's a big crater there, 1, 2, 3. This is the view from Chang'e 4 when it landed, so this is that big crater, and you've got 1, 2, 3 is 1, 2, 3. And this is just as it landed, and then a little bit longer later, here is the rover setting off and exploring. So this is U2. They are looking at the geology, dating when this impact basin was created. That helps us know about the full heavy bombardment, the cratering of the moon. It will survey the mineral composition in the soil. It will understand what's made up. It's also going to do a test of low-frequency radio astronomy on the far side of the moon. That's an idea I'll come back to later. And one of the more exciting things they did is they also sent a whole lot of seeds. So cotton seeds and, cotton seeds, rape seed, potato seeds. No, you can get potato seeds, I must admit. And this is supposed to show you, I think it's this, the first sprout. It's a little bit vague, but this was proudly unveiled that this is the first seed that is grown on the moon. So you're testing the very weak lunar gravity. However, I will say that these seeds were enclosed within an environment that protected from the very cold temperatures and the harsh radiation that you get on the lunar surface. But anyway, this purportedly shows the first plant to germinate on another world. Unfortunately, it didn't last long, probably again because of the extreme cold. All the sprouts perished within a couple of weeks, again, probably due to the cold. And the trouble is, with the moon, you have fortnight-long nights, so and the temperature can drop enormously in those times. During the night time, you have to hibernate the rover, you have to turn up all the electronics and what have you, because it's too cold for all the electronic components to operate. Okay, this is all part, as I say, of a stage mission. At the end of this year, in December, the Chinese are going to send Chang'e 5 to the moon and Chang'e 6 the following year. And these are going to land and collect surface. They're going to grab samples from the surface of the moon and put them in a capsule that then gets brought back to Earth for analysis in the lab. So at the minute, the only real samples we get from the moon are from the Apollo missions and any lunar meteorites that have to come our way. This is going to start bringing back new samples of the lunar surface for analysis in the lab. And the Chinese, this is all the first start of what is ultimately the idea of having a crewed lunar landing, perhaps in the 2030s, with the possibility of building a base near the South Pole eventually. So you can see it's a race between lots of missions, and it's not just, one of the developments is it is of course not just international, national space agencies that are involved. There is now a whole set of private enterprise entering the space race and involved in trying to make much more cost-effective space exploration. You will remember, of course, probably one of the first of these was very famous. More recently, Israel have just sent a mission to the moon. It's a private Israeli organization called SpaceIL, but this was this was prompted by the Google X Prize. It's a prize of $30 million for the first private company to go and land a rover on the moon that was capable of traveling 500 meters. Now, that touchdown didn't happen in time for the limit, so the Google X Prize has ceased, but nonetheless, it stimulated a lot of interest from private companies going to the moon. This, the landing is the main objective, but it will carry experiments looking at the magnetic field of the moon. Japanese Space Agency are very serious about going back to the moon. Just, again, in the last week, there's this press release about JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, collaborating with Toyota to design, and here's the concept of a lunar rover that can, it be pressurized, it'll be protected. The astronauts can travel up to 10,000 kilometers across the moon. They don't need to be wearing their spacesuits. They're sitting in pressurized cabins. And this will be pure powered by a fuel cell. So this is going to be, you know, if this came to fruition, this could carry astronauts to explore the moon for several weeks at a time. And you may be familiar with, you know, NASA has invited several private companies in the US to collaborate with bids to build and launch American probes as part of this bid to return to the moon. There's a SpaceX company which has already developed the Dragon spacecraft, which successfully docked the International Space Station, most recently carrying a dummy astronaut on board as a dry representing astronauts to the space agent. Well, they're also developing the Falcon heavy launch vehicle, so these are just artist's impressions of it in action. But this is something they really intend to start using. They already have got their first private passengers signed up to fly on a trip to the moon. Now, they won't land on the moon, It'll be about a six-day mission where they go round the moon, but this will be the first return by people to the moon, and that's planned around 2023. Okay. And beyond that, were their intentions for astronauts and moon bases have been declared by, okay, so Europe, Russia, China, Japan, India, like the National Space Agencies. And the general timescale is astronauts, perhaps late 2020s, early 2030s, followed by sending up lunar outposts. Russia planned, for example, to send cosmonauts into orbit around the moon by 2025. Here's a development of, just a concept of a lunar orbital station, so like a space station around Earth, but one that goes around the moon, perhaps after about 2030. And everybody's working towards perhaps a base on the moon, a crewed base on the moon. So the big question is, why do we want to send people back to the moon? I'm a great proponent of robotic exploration. We don't need to send people. They're expensive to send there. It's hazardous for them. Not only do you have the lack of air and water on the moon, which is kind of dire if you want to live there, the reduced gravity has enormous effects on your health. It reduces you. Without gravity to work against, you have muscle loss. You have all kinds of effects on health. Again, part of the radiation environment affects your bone density. It makes them brittle. We know this from studying the effects of long stays in the space station from astronauts. There's no atmosphere in the moon, no magnetic field. You're exposed to intense radiation from the sun that can cause cancers, that can damage you. The moon dust itself, there's no weathering, there's no wind, water on the moon. It's sharp, it's possibly toxic. It could interfere with electronic components. So just your basic survival of humans on the moon is quite difficult. And it's clear that the exploration at first will be entirely robotic. So a lot of the motivation for going back to the moon is scientific knowledge that can be gained. Now, the geology of the moon is well preserved, you know, because you don't have any weathering. Anything that's hit the moon is left a crater, so you have a pristine impact history of the moon. That tells us something about the history of the inner solar system and when this peppering from asteroids and bits of junk rock happened. And indeed, you know, every crater on the moon comes from one of these lumps of space rock. And indeed, the whole Earth-Moon system is thought to have formed together. We're going to get an idea of how important the moon perhaps was in forming an Earth. What does that tell us about potential habitable planets in the right turn around their stars? How unique is this Earth-Moon system and what are the implications? That means we need to know a lot more about the history of the moon. And also, if you collect rocks from the surface, they could well contain lumps of Earth that were jettisoned, perhaps by early meteorites hitting the surface of the Earth. A really big blast would send bits of rock into space that may later land on the moon. So it's possible that from the moon we may get samples of Earth from about 4 billion years ago. And how exciting would that be? Because we don't know what Earth was like 4 billion years ago, because it's all got, we've all had geological activity and weathering and everything's changed since the early Earth. But the moon could preserve that kind of record. So the science of the moon, the science from the moon, this is on Earth, okay, so that's not really what we're doing, but you have beautiful long dark nights for long observations. You don't have light pollution on the far side of the moon. There are very serious ideas. I told you the Chinese are looking at testing some radio astronomy on the far side of the moon. Very serious ideas that you could bulldoze a crater, build a big radio dish. You don't have any of the radio interference because you're in the sort of shadow of the moon on the far side. You don't have all the radio signals you have on Earth. And again, it's just an artist's impression with perhaps a big radio telescope in the background, which could be operated almost remotely. And it's also an ideal place for keeping an eye on our local neighbourhood, potentially Earth-crossing asteroids that could potentially, you know, present a hazard to us in the future. The science on the moon, okay, fanciful interpretation, especially given that Chinese one leaf sprouting from a seed. But we need to understand the stability of biological and organic systems under hostile conditions. So you look at the radiation, the temperature, the low gravity. There's also the possibility that low gravity may be good for manufacturing, for engineering. And that brings us the idea of perhaps opening up the surface of the moon to potentially industrial or commercial opportunities. You have lots of solar power. You don't have the clouds, you don't have the atmospheres. You collect solar energy and beam it back to Earth somehow. Though I'm not quite sure the idea of quite beaming it back to Earth, something dangerous. So they have Flash Gordon or something. But in particular, so the Chinese mission, one of their objectives is to, again, artist's impression, you have the possibility that on the surface of the moon, deep, perhaps about a metre deep in the lunar soil, is something called helium-3, which is a non-radioactive isotope of helium, which could provide very efficient and, in particular, non-radioactive nuclear fusion power. And some people are very excited about the possibility of actually being able to mine the moon for this source, for a very cheap and non-invasive power on the Earth. Obviously we will learn a lot from this, but the moon is a safe stepping stone before we go to Mars or anywhere else. You're only a few days away, you're in much more immediate contact with the Earth in terms of practice and prepare for a human mission to other planets of our solar system. And in some ways, the environment on the Moon and Mars are similar. So we can check things about propulsion, you know, minimise the length of time that astronauts have to spend in unprotected space. The landing, we're already testing that, you know, just those autonomous things without having to rely on an atmosphere for braking. How you sustain life in a hostile environment, harnessing natural resources when you're there. And all of this is done only within about 3 days' travel from Earth, rather than several days away. And it could well be that the moon itself would be a good stepping stone to go on to Mars. Maybe you mine, you build your spaceships there, and then with less gravity to launch, it's quicker to launch, so it's easier to launch them onto Mars. There are all kinds of ideas. Whatever we do, it's not going to be just humans. There are going to be robots involved. We're used to autonomous robots doing our dirty work for us. Well, here's the NASA equivalent of WALL-E. So you not just have the landers and the rovers that are in advance of any crew landing, checking for potential landing sites, the suitability, looking for hidden water that's probably locked away as ice. We'll have to send major Earth-moving machinery to do the kind of heavy lifting, the construction work that might be needed before we build a base. And again, these are going to have to be perhaps working autonomously without instruction from Earth all the time, without being, perhaps being remote controlled from Earth or maybe from a lunar orbiter. And even when the astronauts arrive, it's all going to be done, humans and robots working together. So it's a very different view of human exploration than happened 50 years ago. And there's an awful lot that's got to happen before then. So there is also serious consideration already about where you would build a permanent lunar outpost. The important thing is the presence of water ice. And this is partly why there's been so much mapping of the moon for water underneath. And the South Pole is very promising. Here's just a picture of the South Pole. Again, the blue shows you reflectance of where there could be deposits of water ice buried in the soil. In particular, people are very interested in this little crater here. It's called Shackleton Crater. Here's an image of it. It's a nice spot. You're right down where you have the rim of the crater is in sunshine for about 80% of the day, so it's very nice to collect. You could line up all your solar panels along the edge. Most of the crater's in permanent shade, so there's the potential of having water ice down here. And there are mountains in the immediate vicinity which are high enough that they're in continual contact with the Earth, being right down at the South Pole. So people are thinking very seriously about this being one of the, down at the South Pole, being the potential site for lunar bases. And finally, just think, given that we're being so clever about doing everything robotically, it does somewhat weaken the case for human return, human space flight to the moon. But I just want to remind you that our quest for scientific knowledge is not an exclusive motivator in a return to the moon. There is also this issue of exploration, about this human desire to explore. And it's worth considering space exploration as a challenging, shared, and a peaceful activity for international cooperation. And in the same way that the International Space Station is the largest international peacetime venture, you have the possibility, which we have to hold on in these current days, of international collaboration between space agencies. And indeed, almost the best analogy of what might happen is the Antarctic. Here's just a picture from the base down near the South Pole. And if you think about Antarctic exploration, there was this race right in, you know, at late 19th, early 20th century, people wanting to be the first to the South Pole. A few flurries of expeditions, and once that had been achieved, nothing happened for some decades until technology moved on and you had motorized skidoos or you had airplanes. And through the 1930s and 50s, there began to be a return. And then eventually, as the technology improves, you develop a base, you then start having permanent crews at the base doing the science, and potentially now, of course, you have tourists, and it could well be that we'll have tourists going to the moon base as well. So think of exploration to the moon. Yes, there will be science, but to do the science, and we probably have to do the exploration. Exploration isn't the same as science, but it will enable and does enable the science in the future. And indeed, I think we're living in a fantastic time. I hope you've got the sense that things are really moving, even this year, and within our lifetimes, we can expect a human return to the moon. Thank you very much.